Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your guest host, Zoe Russell. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Thanks goes out to Michael McKay, Radio Free Market's founder and host, for letting me fill this guest slot. Our topic today is the history of inflation with Dr. Hunt Tooley. Dr. Tooley is a professor of history at Austin College in Sherman, Texas. He specializes in modern European history and is the author of The Western Front, about the battle fronts and home fronts of the First World War, as well as National Identity in Weimar Germany, a book about ethnic politics and violence resulting from Germany's defeat in 1918. He is an adjunct faculty member of the Ludwig von Mises Institute and our honored guest for today. This is a live call-in show, so please give us a call at 1-800-313-9443. Again, that's 1-800-313-9443. Thank you for being on the show, Dr. Tooley.
Very welcome, Zoe. It's nice to talk to you.
Now, it's one of my greatest thrills in life to learn about history, not through a sanctioned textbook and without a politically correct lacquer covering the surface. And I know that the history of governments issued money is some of the most dubiously reported history out there. Can you just give us a backdrop of what the economy was like when you first taught the History of Inflation course at Austin College?
Well, I certainly can, Zoe. Pardon me. The when I taught the course, it was really the summer before the crash of our current Great Recession, and I began thinking a lot about the inflation rate, and I had intended to do a course in the history of inflation for quite a few years, and I thought, well, this is a perfect time to do it. And little did I know that we would have a kind of a clinical study of the business cycle as we went through our course, in fact, at the very beginning of our course. So it kind of shocked us into a sort of seriousness as we went through it.
Right. When I first learned about Austrian economics, or reality economics, as Michael McKay likes to call it, in the fall of 2007, the country had just cusped the height of the housing boom, and my professor seemed marvelously prophetic when home loans began to crumble and talking heads kept using phrases like animal spirits. Now, I know you had to confront the prevailing Keynesian myths where we find money management and animal spirits with the Austrian theory of the business cycle. So we're about to head into break, but just start explaining to us, what is the Austrian theory of the business cycle, and what does it have to do with inflation?
Well, very briefly, it's just the story of inflation. When governments inflate, then the currency depreciates. It seems like there's an easy time in the economy, and it gets hotter and hotter and builds up into a kind of a currency bubble, and then it all crashes down, and what follows is sometimes called a depression, sometimes a recession, but whatever it's called, it's the correction back to some kind of honesty within the market, as opposed to the dishonesty of that inflation that happens. So it's a cycle introduced by inflation, by the fact of inflation, and for the most part, and so the cycle itself is a corrective sort of mechanism in the economy.
So how do you define inflation versus how we're taught to recognize inflation?
Well, that's a good question, Zoe, because in most cases today, inflation is just simply defined as higher prices of some kind, and governments, the modern state is quite interested to make sure that people have that definition in their mind, that it's somehow a kind of, as you say, sort of an animal spirit sort of affair, or sort of a mystical thing that prices just kind of go up. But in fact, it's the creation of more currency or more money in the form of credit and other ways that that makes this a that means that makes the inflation to begin with.
I see. Well, we're about to go to a break, so we'll be right back to delve into the history of inflation with Dr. Hunt Tooley. Welcome back, everyone, to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host for today in place of Michael McKay. I'm Zoe Russell. This is a live show. If you're wanting to call in, just call us at 1-800-313-9443. With me is Dr. Hunt Tooley, and we're just discussing the history of inflation. Let's travel back in time to 14th century Europe. Murray Rothbard, a great Austrian economic scholar, pointed out that rather than a linear and continuous progression in human development from the 11th century onward, as is generally believed, there was a period in Europe from around 1300 to the mid-1500s marked by a severe drop in population and an economic decline. And this is normally blamed on the Black Plague, but Rothbard says we've got to understand what caused the lower living standards that allowed the plague to flourish in the first place. Can you tell us what caused these lower living standards across Europe in the 14th century?
Well, Zoe, part of what was going on there was that this is the precise period in which the modern state in its modern form began to rise, and what had been in place previously was a much more localized kind of rule across Europe, whether it was independent towns with their city patriciates or senates or councils, or on the land feudal nobles who were lords of their own castle and so forth. And what happened was that in conjunction with the Crusades, which began about 1100 or so, and then various other influences, that this state came to the fore, and the state began to almost immediately to have to manipulate wealth into its own coffers so that it could, in fact, conquer these local authorities like the cities and the nobles and so forth. So there's a big struggle there, and that's part of the economic decline as more wealth of large populations began to make their way into the hands of this you might say authority, but you might say it's just a kind of corporate entity that came out of nowhere. It's as if we decided today that there would be a club, and suddenly that club was the leader of everything. So it's the creation of the state, really, and the formation of the state that we get a lot of these disjunctions, and a lot of the monetary and therefore and the currency kinds of issues too. Although we don't have paper currency until a little bit later, we do have a lot of messing around with the coinage and with other forms of money.
Mm. So I guess we can move on from there. That's sort of the point where kings would take over the minting of coins. Let's move on to one of the great tales in inflationary history. Can you tell us what happened during King Henry VIII's reign in England, also called the Great Debasement?
Sure, that's an interesting episode. Henry VIII was, along with a number of other princes in Europe, what we historians call it a new monarch, and these were the monarchs who really first were able to marshal this central authority and assert their authority over these older local allegiances. And all these new monarchs contrived to, as I say, this is an illustration of my description of the rise of the state. I mean, they contrived to get the money of people into the state's coffers, and Henry VIII did this in a number of ways. And most people have an idea that they understand that Henry VIII was a very aggressive, acquisitive, centralized monarch, and he took over the Church of England, and he redefined all kinds of things, and he conquered a piece of Ireland and took over all the Catholic churches, monasteries, etc., etc. But another way that he was able to fill the coffers of his growing state with his growing bureaucracy and growing military forces was to inflate the currency, but here through coinage debasement. And what he did, pure and simple, was to call on the abilities of those much maligned alchemists, and here they weren't looking for a sort of key to everlasting life. He just used their chemical and metallurgical skills to debase, literally debase the currency. They would just bring the gold and silver pieces in, and as they cycle through and replace those with much, much debased, alloys that had mostly much cheaper metals in those. So there was a great debasement. This did create inflation because suddenly there were more coins to be put out. And so as there were more coins, of course, as the currency depreciated and was debased, then each coin was actually worth less. So this is a kind of a startling way to think about an early inflation in European history, because you don't even need paper money for this to happen if the coinage is debased. Previous to this, there had been a lot of coin clipping and that sort of thing, but there's only so far you can go when you're shaving the edges off coins to create more coins. People notice pretty soon that their coins are smaller than they were. With the debasement, people were supposed to sort of believe this, and after a while it became this kind of open fiction. But the currency was inflated, and therefore this basic process of legal plunder that, as Bastiat would call this and many other kinds of state-sanctioned money manipulation and wealth manipulation, this kind of legal plunder then led to Henry VIII being much richer, and England being much richer and being able to finance all those fleets that established naval predominance and eventually, later on, beat the Armada at sea, and then went off and got colonies, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow.
So that's the story of the Great Debasement. There's many other stories of these new monarchs manipulating coinage, manipulating wealth in every kind of way that we can think of, really, in their circumstances. And it's also interesting, Zoe, if I can just continue for a second on this episode, it's also interesting that at this moment in European history, for about 100 years before Henry VIII, modern banking had its birth. It's in this realm of history that the government first begins to delve into the banking business. Mm-hmm. So that banks, which originally were just basically storehouses for commodities of gold and silver, in other words, the coins were basically commodities. In these cases, governments began to just go to these banks and say, well, we're going to take a third of this gold here. The bankers would say, well, it's not ours to give, we're just storing it. And the governments would say, it's okay, we'll make it a non-fraudulent thing for you to say that we will simply, that you can simply take people's money and only have the reserves, only have gold and silver enough to cover a part of it. So this is also, in the earliest stages of modern banking, there's also the birth of fractional reserve banking, which, of course, is one of the most serious modern problems of inflationary legal plunder, because the inflation of credit also acts as the inflation of money does.
So it's a sense of government-mandated fraud.
Certainly. Government-backed fraud, government-enabled fraud, sure.
I want to point out before we go on, though complicated by these banking practices and paper money, the method of inflation practiced by government after government afterwards is a mirror image of what King Henry did to his people's coins. Would you agree with that?
I think that's right. So that's a good way to put it. I mean, you know, in our... I'm teaching a class at the Mises Academy at this moment, and one thing that happens in the class is that as we look at inflation after inflation from this period, from Henry VIII all the way to the present, I mean current events, that the methods of governments in creating these inflations, and also in dealing with them and talking about them and covering them over and blaming the inflation on somebody else, that is, it's almost, I mean, it's interesting, but all, it has this almost monotonous quality to it, in that it all looks the same. We covered a recent op-ed piece the other night that we'd read for the class, and the writer said, "Well, this is an amazing thing, and in Argentina, they're using these unorthodox methods of wage and price controls to keep the price down, even though they continue to lower the discount rate for credit." And so that means they're inflating, mm-hmm. but then they intervene in the market to make it appear, they think, so that there is no inflation by means of wage and price controls. And, of course, this is the oldest trick in the book. Henry
right.
VIII did this too.
Right. And so let's see. When the public fights a tax increase and nobody wants to lend their savings to the king, that's when the devious partnership between bankers and politicians, also known as the central bank, comes about. It's a hidden tax through inflation.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, and that develops over a century. I mean, I think one thing that happened was that you do get the rise of these central banks, and this is an important part of the story.
Well, let me cut you off right there.
Very good.
And
yeah,
we'll go out to break, but we'll be right back with Radio Free Market and Dr. Hunt Tooley. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Zoe Russell, and we're here with Dr. Tooley of Austin College. We've got a caller, Leo from Massachusetts. Leo, are you on the line?
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. What college were you from, sir?
I teach at Austin College.
B-O-S-T-O-N?
No. Austin, A-U-S-T-I-N.
Oh, okay. Austin.
As in Stephen F. Austin. He was the founder of our college. No, he was the founders named him named the college after him. Sorry.
Now the thing is that I see the conversion as being very, very difficult when you try to get people to convert from the standard cash system, that they look at you as though you have three heads, and this is the problem. I see a lot of us in the choir understand and get it. But we in the choir have a very hard time talking to the parishioners, and that's where the real major disconnect is happening. And it's a tragic major disconnect that we have to really pay attention to.
So I guess the question, are you as confounded as all of us are that people continually call the next boom the new economy and the next inflationary period a great thing?
Yeah. Yeah, well, Leo makes that's a crucial point from the standpoint of some kind of change. And of course, the first part of my answer, Leo, would be that education is a key to it. And it is true that those of us in choir, like yourself and like me, we understand that. And there have to be ways to persuade people. And I think that in many ways this radio show and this network and other endeavors like this are helping. But it is true that there is a kind of sea change that has to take place. And I don't know. It may be that the crisis is the time to make a lot of headway. It is the case that as Robert Higgs said in his great classic about the crisis nature of Leviathan, that the state has proceeded and grown and been nurtured through crises, and it may be that it's time for the side of individualism to use a crisis to do the same thing. But it's a very good point. Excellent point.
Well, I think to be a little Keynesian about it. I think so many of the people nowadays, their minds are half empty, and that's the real problem. I mean, I talked to a kid just at a gas station just now, and I asked him if he knew about Stalin, and he said, "Who's that?" And this is like a teenager who's, you know, like 20 or so, 1920, and it really boggled my mind that when I said a word like that, he said, "Who's that?" So this is what we're having. you are talking to the choir, and we're not getting it to the people. And this is where the major disconnect is. And if we fail to recognize this, our efforts will be for naught. And this is what really scares me.
It's a very good point, and I agree with you. And there, that could be a whole show in and of itself, I think, Zoe.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think one of the great tools we have is Mises.org. That's Mises.org. So if y'all want to get any information on the history of economics, go there and use that as your tool to fight back against these false claims that are reoccurring over and over and over again. And I want to tell you, I went to Mises University, and the students that I met there were, I mean, they were unbelievable how smart they were, and it was such a warm feeling to know that around the whole world, young people are waking up to this, and I do think we have to use the crises as the time to spread the message, because people are willing to listen at that time. But moving on, let's just talk about the central bank, and we'll go inside of this confusing, confounding sort of system. Can you tell us the basic structure of the central banking system? The first central bank was the Bank of England. Can you just tell us how it works?
Sure, Zoe, and I'll be especially historical about this, because the Bank of England, which was founded in the 1690s, really kind of wrote the book on the central bank. I mean, what happened in England was that the merchant control of the economy, at the expense of you might say individual enterprise and so forth, but you might say mercantile control, in which big rent-seeking companies got in with the government and were interested in controlling wealth that was public as well as their own private funds. And so these interests got together and formed up this bank that would, in fact, kind of allow them to buy money when they needed to, sell money when they needed to keep the money on an even keel, to set rates of credit and so forth. And so the central bank allowed the government to exert a greater control over the course of its empire and the course of war fighting and so forth and so on.
Let's short break right there.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry, and we'll come back to our long segment and explain this further with Dr. Hunt Tooley. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm Zoe Russell, the guest host today, and Dr. Hunt Tooley is our guest. We were just discussing the structure of the first central bank, the Bank of England, which basically is similar to every central bank that exists today. Can you continue telling us about the structure of the Bank of England?
Well, I'd really like to start there and then move on to other banks too, because really this after the 1790s, this whole idea of the central bank as a kind of way of, as a you might say a kind of tool of the government to control the economy. That spread to other countries, so that the Dutch set up a central bank in about, a few years later, in 1718, the Royal Bank of France was founded, and gradually the great powers set up these banks that would act as a central bank. But of course, in terms of inflation, one of the crucial points here was the use of paper currency. Which was introduced in the 17th century it was introduced at a few moments in earlier history, but basically it's a 17th century, something that happened in the 1600s. And so there are these times in the 1700s when there's widespread experimentation with it, almost always leading to a vast, vast inflation that we call a hyperinflation, where the paper money was just printed and printed and printed, and then And then the business cycle ensued, and there was a huge crash. The currency was, whatever it was ruined and debased and totally depreciated along the lines of what happens today in Zimbabwe or Argentina or some other place.
We're told that one of the jobs of the Federal Reserve is to control inflation, but I guess it's control inflation to the point where we don't notice it too much. It's still a steady stream of income for the government.
Well, I do think that that's the lesson that central banks have learned over the centuries, and that is to, in other words, if inflation part of the theory of the Austrian theory of inflation is, of course, that as the government is printing up the money or expanding the currency, that basically there's a kind of theft that's going on, this legal plunder that that Bastiat talked about. And what happens in inflation is that if you steal too much, for example, in the case of Zimbabwe today, you get the government of Robert Mugabe, you might say unashamed at its theft in many ways. I mean, not just in inflationary ways, but in taxation and confiscation, all the other ways a government can increase its finances. But in the case of Zimbabwe, the second greatest inflation that ever occurred is just behind us. Maybe there's another one in the future, and the government has by these means, and Mugabe personally have really just gained billions of dollars worth of loot from all that. So yes, the more sophisticated central banks in modern times have taken these lessons from the great inflation in France, from the Mississippi bubble in France, from the greenback episode in America in the 1860s and 1870s, from the German inflation after World War I. They've taken these lessons and said, okay, well, let's not take so much that it destroys the system. And essentially, that's not the message of Keynesian thought, of the Keynesian thought on the issue of inflation, but it is the result. Let's not take too much so that people don't quite realize that, that wealth is being transferred from people's wallets to government coffers.
Right. And one of the most common patterns for the government to inflate and transfer wealth is to fund a war effort and a sneaky transfer of property and wealth from private individuals to the state went hand in hand with the new mindset of the late 19th century Europe. There was a buildup of national pride, of seeing oneself as part of a group rather than an individual, and they lobbied the government for protection of their said group. And this progression away from liberty is really what pushed the world to the brink of World War I. So what kind of precedents did World War I establish in terms of government control and a government command economy?
I like your summary there very much, Zoe. That's a good way to put this. In a way, inflation was always connected in one way or the other with war. And indeed, paper currencies were usually in the 1600s and 1700s connected with war. In these cases in France that I've mentioned, Henry VIII's debasement earlier on. So there's a real connection there anyway, because wars cost so much money. I mean, it's basically the most expensive human activity. What that means is that once you get a huge, enormously destructive war in prospect, as Europeans had in 1914, then the fact of the matter is that most European finance specialists just didn't see how it could be paid for at all. But luckily, or unluckily luckily for the state and unluckily for others, governments figured out how to expropriate, how to extract wealth from people to such a degree that huge war could be fought with all its unbelievable expenses, and inflation was one of the tools. I mean, you get down to it, and governments can confiscate money to put in their treasury. Governments can tax people, they can borrow. I mean, there are numerous ways that governments can obtain wealth, but the great thing about inflation is that unlike taxes and confiscation, that not many people really know about it. It's a secret kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And here's where the propaganda comes in. I mentioned at the beginning that governments always try to blame this on somebody else. And it's perfect because you can say, well, prices are rising and we don't know what's going on. Could be those evil farmers. This happened in Germany. There's a whole, in 1914, 15, there's a whole episode where the government blamed farmers for increasing pork prices and increasing bread prices and so forth. And so a lot of city folks began to hate the farmers, and there was a big, actually killing off of pigs in 1915, but I won't go into that. In the midst of war, they slaughtered several million pigs. But this propaganda then covers over the fact that the government is in fact transferring money. So in World War One, all governments inflated their currency. At the end of the war, prices were up by a factor of 10 in France, factor of 8 or 9 in England, factor of 20 or 25 in Germany, about the same in Austria. So everybody has inflated the currency during the war, in addition to borrowing and doing other means of carrying out other means of getting revenues. But so this is a really important point that you've made, that inflation is associated with war. It doesn't always happen in a kind of direct relationship, but frequently after the war, the chickens come home to roost, and then there is often an even greater inflation after the war, oftentimes hyperinflation. So we have the example of Germany in the period 1918 to 1923. There's this huge inflation, enormous. Hungary at the same time has the greatest inflation that is on record anywhere. Then after World War II, we also have inflation in Germany and Japan and China and other places. So it certainly is true that inflation is very much connected with war, especially the hyperinflationary type.
So I just want to destroy any underlying thought that the cost of war is a necessary evil, that war is somehow good for the economy. Can you tell us why the Great War, why all war is bad for prosperity?
Well, I think that's there's this myth that that governments and some academics and writers who are either misunderstand or purposefully want to spin things in a different way. There's this myth that wars are helpful to the economy, as you suggest, but in fact, how can they be, since they are a destructive enterprise? I mean, one of the characteristics of war is that all your effort these days goes into making bombs, which are designed to not only to destroy themselves but to destroy things around them. So it's the remotest kind of activity from a productive activity. So all this non-productive activity, which will not lead to somebody consuming the food that you grow or the clothing that you make or whatever the product is, it is essentially non-productive. So there's no possible way that a war could make a better world in that sense, in the sense of more productivity, more goods for people, allowing people, especially at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, to have access to goods and services and whatnot. No possible way.
So war, though, is not necessarily bad for everyone, just as inflation is not bad for everyone equally. Who benefits from the war and the inflation?
Well, in inflation, those are related questions, but they're two different questions. In inflation, it is true that people who are say deeply in debt benefit from inflation because they can pay back their debts with money that's worth less, and yet the debt is the same. So with a hyperinflation, if somebody owed in Germany in 1919 20 million marks, if by 1923 they could have paid that off by working a morning, and just paying off the debt. So that is true. Debtors profit there. People who can somehow have access to foreign money or have reserves of gold and so forth. And then of course the governments profit from the inflation because they're the ones moving the value from the public's wallets to into their treasury. So those people do. In wartime, a lot of people profit. Of course, the companies usually semi-public or tied to the government in some way or contracted to the government. These companies make vast sums of money. The famous arms merchants, as they used to call them in the 30s. The state profits, and as a great American intellectual put it, war is the health of the state. I mean, the state profits enormously by this, by the whole process of getting more money, of seeming more important, being at the center of all this kind of sacred activity of warfare. And so you're exactly right. There are plenty of entities and groups and individuals who profit by war and inflation.
So at the same time that war calls on the public at large to be patriotic and moral and give up their individualism to the country, it creates a breed of sort of crony capitalists that solely relies on the state to confiscate all their property for their own personal profits.
Exactly, Zoe, and it has done that for all these years. As you just put it, you can find exactly that description in a number of letters from George Washington, who condemns what he calls stock jobbers and people kind of working on that. And by the way, the American Revolutionary War was a period of enormous inflation because they too relied on this on inflationary financing. Mm. This is a pattern that is very much a part and parcel of the whole thing.
And now with that, well, after the First World War and during the Great Depression, we saw the beginnings of the Keynesian Revolution. And John Maynard Keynes sort of challenged the proposition that a market economy could heal itself. What did his revolution bring about?
Well, Keynes, in this regard, hoped to use inflation as a tool of governmental finance, and his idea was that if you make easy money, if you make money easy to get and credit easy to get, then there will always be a little bit more business, a little bit more a few more jobs available, and so forth and so on, so that if you can hit the balance, he thought, between inflating the currency at a kind of controlled rate and keeping people in sort of jobs in what economists call the margin of the economy, these marginal enterprises that probably wouldn't make it if money weren't easy. So if you keep that kind of process going, then there will always be low unemployment and basically the government can just kind of manage it. Of course, this requires a whole sort of technocratic elite of economics and finance people to tweak the system constantly in order to do this, and it also involves continual inflation for the most part. You're always inflating, so that means since as Austrians view this, inflation is theft on the part of the government, then essentially there's a continual kind of injustice happening. In other words, this person works hard for her property, and the government is stealing that property away without telling anybody by means of inflation. So so that's the idea, and those are the flaws of that whole Keynesian idea related to inflation.
So he's sort of turned inflation into a science?
Yeah, I think so, or tried to. That was the idea. A little later on in the 1950s, an Australian economist named Phillips made more of a science of it and produced the famous Phillips curve, in which he showed that all things being equal, that really a continual inflation really meant a low rate of unemployment. And of course, the problem was that this was disproved in the early 1970s in the period of stagflation.
Right. Well, let's talk about stagflation when we come back from this break. So we'll have our final segment of today's Radio Free Market with Dr. Hansouli. Hello, and welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Zoe Russell. I just wanted to start where we left off. Can you just tell us what happened after World War II? There was a decision made by all the world leaders called the Bretton Woods Agreement. What was that?
Well, Zoe, the Bretton Woods Conference took place in 1944, just before the end of the war, and one of the prominent figures and crucial decision makers was none other than John Maynard Keynes at the conference. And it was agreed that after the dislocations of the war and the depression economies of the 1930s, that there'd be a regime of worldwide money management in which essentially everybody related their currencies to everybody else's, and this was all pegged to what was called the reserve currency, and that was the United States dollar. Of interest, I think, is that at the time one of the leading Austrian commentators, Austrian economics commentators, Henry Hazlitt, waged a kind of one-man war against this in newspaper op-ed pieces and books and so forth, and said, you know, it couldn't work because if for no other reason than eventually, when the United States decided to inflate its currency, that other countries could just simply come in and buy dollars and the cheaper dollars, and then exchange those for gold or silver and take away the gold reserves of the United States, which is exactly what happened in the 1960s. So it was a regime in which there was a sort of remote connection between currencies and metal still, a kind of notional connection. You could swap dollar bills for some amount of gold. But what happened was that as inflation increased at the end of, things were pretty steady in the early 60s, and at the end of the 60s, what with the costs of the Vietnam War, et cetera, and of course the welfare programs of the mid-60s, then there was a lot of inflation, so as gold reserves seemed as if they would disappear from America, then President Nixon simply took the United States completely off the gold standard and cut any remaining tie between gold, so that at that point Bretton Woods was essentially dead, and the current system, which is total fiat money or total just created money, notional paper money, took center stage, and that's the way it's remained ever since.
So have we had many more bubbles and busts and more extreme bubbles and busts since that happened?
Well, we certainly have since the 50s and 60s, because the inflation rates since then have we're just talking about the United States here, but in the United States there are many bubbles and busts. Of course, the one we've just gone through, the bust that we've just gone through, is the biggest of those. But you know, we can think of the early 80s and late 80s and the early 90s and so forth. Yeah, it's a kind of continuous sort of bubble policy. And this is, you know, this is the sort of things that Austrian economists have dined out on for all these years. I mean, they're the ones who actually have predicted that all these kinds of things would happen. So kudos to those economists from
right.
this Austrian-influenced historian.
Yes, and you're one of them. I want to thank you, Dr. Hunt-Tooley, for being with us today. This is Zoe Russell and Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can download this and all of our shows for free. And until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.